You're listening to ABC Radio National, and this is Julian Morrow with you on Sunday Extra. In 2024, thanks to an anonymous benefactor, the State Library of New South Wales created the Imago Fellowship, a $50,000 grant for creative writing, fiction or non-fiction across any genre, that utilises the collections of the State Library of New South Wales. By the way, applications for the 2026 Fellowship close at the end of July. But the inaugural Imago Fellow was writer and postdoctoral researcher at UTS, Sheila Nock-Pham. Sheila used her fellowship to explore the life and work of an Australian author who wrote the book that gave her one of the most intense reading experiences of her childhood. Sheila's written about what she found during her Imago Fellowship in the autumn edition of the State Library's magazine Open Book. And I'm very pleased to say that Sheila joins us now on Sunday Extra. Welcome, Sheila.
Hi, Julian. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Now tell us, what was that most intense reading experience of your childhood?
It's funny to hear it reflected back that way, but it's true. It was one of the most intense reading experiences of my childhood. It's a novel called The Land Behind the World by Anne Spencer Parry. And so she passed away 40 years ago, and I think largely forgotten, it's safe to say, although I have been meeting people who remember her as well. Mm. But this particular book was very significant in my childhood. And I think this is a story that could only occur before the internet as well. So when I first discovered this book, it was in the early 90s. I would have been about 10 years old. And I discovered it on the bookshelf of a neighbor's house. And I took it home and I read it. And it was just such a relatable work to me in so many ways at that time. And, you know, it's something that really stayed with me. And so I gave the book back and then I kind of yearned for it for like the next decade. I just couldn't get my hands on it again. I mean, I could have gone back to them, of course, but I just, you know, it wasn't sold in the bookshops. I didn't have it in local libraries. And so it was just like this kind of mysterious book that was a once-off experience in my childhood that I didn't encounter again until in my early 20s. And so that's kind of the premise of this whole research project, actually, because what happened is that I have this early memory and then I come back to it in my early 20s and I read the book and I'm like bitterly disappointed with it because it doesn't hold up to a second read. Yeah. And I think it's so interesting. Books can have that presence in your life. You don't always read it the same way because you change as a reader as well. And so with this book, I then had a second experience with it that I made me think that she was a huge Luddite. And in the early 2000s, I loved the internet. And this book is very, I felt it was anti-technology when I read it again in the early 2000s. So that's the start of the project. And it's been such a wonderful experience this last year having an Imago Fellowship to really kind of delve into the archives of Anne Spencer Parry that are held by the State Library.
So you've told us about the first two readings of The Land Behind the World by Anne Spencer Parry. I think the third reading was the one that set you on the path of looking deeper into Anne Spencer Parry's life. Tell us about that reading.
Yeah, so this reading is only possible because of the pandemic. So it's really interesting because that is how I think about this project. So then what happens is, you know, I find that book in the early 2000s in the Dimmicks on George Street in Sydney. And then I bring it home, I read it, I'm crushed by it. You know, I just put it away and don't think about it again. I mean, occasionally I think it might pass my mind again, but I never read it again. I just put it away. But then what happens is a really momentous thing happens in my life is I start having children. And so then by the time we get to 2020 and the pandemic is happening, I'm a second-time mother. I have a newborn child. And around this time I start rethinking and rereading books from childhood and just revisiting the early period of my life now that I have my own children. And then, you know, late one night, you know, I'm breastfeeding, I'm up, you know, having a lot of insomnia during, you know, the early weaning period of having babies. And then I start thinking about what was that book that I read, that I loved, that I hated? And I just started thinking about it again. And it took me a few nights, I think, from memory to then try and work out what it was. And I finally stumbled across a website called Pinchgut Press. And so then there's a little bit of information about this book and very little else on the internet. I think there's a very brief Wikipedia entry, but there's very little about this book and this author. But then I'm intrigued. And so then I buy the ebook that's available through Pinchgut Press and I download it onto my phone and then I read it over a couple of nights. And then it's so strange having a third reading and having this kind of almost out of body experience because I can actually vividly see why I loved it as a 10-year-old and also hated it as like a, you know, a 20-something year old. And so now I'm like a 40-year-old, you know, with children and reading this. And then suddenly I'm thinking, you know, what is it about this book? It's a bit of a weird book. And also it's Australian, which I don't think I actually realized at the time, in fact, maybe in either reading. And so now, you know, I'm 40, I'm a professional writer, and I'm thinking about literature differently too, in Australian literature. And so then I start to get intrigued about who this person was. And I reach out to Pinchcot Press, the person who's behind the website, who it turns out is Kim Hoban. And he's the son of Marjorie Pizer, who was Ann Spencer Parry's late partner.
Amazing. So Ann Spencer Parry is the mysterious author behind the mysterious book, The Land Behind the World. You describe Anne as someone whose works are a testament to the life that she formed from unusual, difficult, and brave choices. So, Sheila, what did you discover about Anne Spencer Parry?
Yeah, so this project has been really interesting for me because it's really been not just a history of Anne, but like a social history of Australia. So Anne Spencer Parry was born in 1931. So 50 years before I'm born in 1981. And also, you know, my family came to Australia as refugees from Vietnam. So I have a very different relationship, I think, to what Australian identity is to maybe to people listening now. But at the same time, I am Australian and I think about what it means to live here and to like, inhabit this continent as a settler. And so with this project, I'm looking at Anne through those eyes as well. So for me, Anne is also the child of migrants. Her father is from Wales, her mother's from England, and she's a first generation Australian too. But the big difference between Anne and I, what I've come to think of this is really that what it means to be a woman. And she's born in 1931, and being a woman born in 1931 is a very restricted time. And I don't know that we talk a lot about this period because this is before second wave feminism and the huge kind of social changes we would see kind of post-World War II. So when Anne is 18, she falls pregnant and she writes about this. The reason why I know about this is in the archives of the State Library, there is a thinly veiled account of her early life. And she basically has sex for the first time and then falls pregnant with a man that she barely knows when she's 18. And at that time, there's no question, I guess she has to keep the child. But also the interesting thing in that book is her mother is relieved that she has fallen pregnant and just basically seems normal because up to this point, she's always been a little bit odd and doesn't quite fit in. And I think just different to the people around her and the girls around her. And so being pregnant and having a child, at least in the book that she's drafted, the mother figure is relieved that this happens. But actually it sets Anne on kind of a dark path really because she very quickly has three children, married to a man she barely knows. And actually, I think she finds the whole experience of being a wife and a mother extremely difficult. And so it's with a lot of bravery and courage that she leaves the family, actually. And this would have been, I'm sure, a very painful and, you know, guilt-ridden decision. But she leaves the family home and the three sons behind when they're still quite young and basically makes her own way out into the world and leaves behind a conventional life and ends up partnering with Marjorie Pizer, a woman. And nowhere in the archives do I see references to her queer identity, but certainly that's what she was because she spends the last 20 years of her life more or less with Marjorie Pizer.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary life path. And I wonder, Sheila, what connections you draw between those aspects of Anne Spencer Parry's life and the nature of the story that she tells in The Land Behind the World.
That's a good question. And I mean, really, the work is a product of her imagination and longings and questions that she has about the world. I mean, so the book essentially is what we would call speculative fiction now. I mean, it's fantasy, but there's some sort of sci-fi elements because of the technology involved. So I think calling it speculative fiction is probably about right. And I think it really does reflect something unusual about Anne in that she's this woman who is born in 1931. And in a short space of time, technology really becomes a huge force in, I think, the lives of people in Australia and elsewhere around the world during that time. And in the book, what we see is a struggle between, I guess, the material world and the technology that's kind of encroaching on it, like plastic, like computers and that. And then the struggle for more spiritual concerns that Anne has. Because the thing that I've discovered through this project is that Anne's a deeply spiritual and religious person, actually. And it's a very interesting part of the story. And in fact, it's a huge part of the story that I don't know that we always talk about the relationship between like religion and fantasy in terms of fantasy writing. But in this case, with Anne's journey, her family are Christian, but she, you know, doesn't believe in that. She turns to Buddhism for a while, has a miserable experience of that, becomes a Scientologist for a bit. And then eventually she converts to Judaism in 1969. And I think most likely that it is influenced by being with Marjorie Pizer, who is from a Jewish background herself, although she's not religious. And the book is infused with actually Jewish names and identity and ideas as well. And I didn't know that when I first read it, of course. It's only through digging through the archives and reading up on the notes and looking at what the thinking behind this work that is very strongly influenced by Anne's conversion to Judaism. And I think she writes in her letters that she really yearns for religion. I think she really finds that structure helpful for her own kind of life, because she, maybe in some ways, she's a bit of a lost soul. And that's something that is a recurring theme in these books, this idea of souls being lost. And so it's a bit, how can I say it? The book is a bit woo-woo for my taste these days. But I think it's very intriguing because it does reflect some of her own sort of personal struggles, but she's kind of then manifested it as a kind of a fictional series that did find quite a wide readership.
Yes, indeed. There's certainly a poignancy to the desire for a fantasy, different world, a land behind the world, given what you've now told us about the life that was Anne Spencer Parry, certainly in the early years. And as you say, Sheila, what Anne Spencer Parry wrote clearly resonated not just with you, but with what seems to be like a series of small waves of interest from different readers. So I wonder if you could tell us how it was published initially, and then what happened to the book after that first publication?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story of the 70s as well, this book. So, I mean, in that time, there's, you know, a lot of independent publishing happening in Australia. I don't know if people realize, but Australia is a very conservative place in the publishing world during this time. And then in the 70s, things start to kind of open up a little bit. And so at that time, you know, Anne Spencer Parry and her partner, Marjorie Pizer, basically self-published this book. And I think that at that time, there's quite a lot of this sort of activity happening from different kinds of people. And so they self-published this book because there's such is their belief in it that they put their own money into it and print 3,000 copies. And basically, I think they're essentially just like walking around to bookshops and distributing it that way. So they don't have like nationwide distribution or anything like that. That kind of infrastructure doesn't exist in the way it does now, of course. But one of the early readers, for example, of those 3,000 copies was a young director named Chris Noonan, who would later on become very famous because of his work on Babe. And he's so taken with the book that he writes to Anne and then ask if he can adapt it for a screen. And so there's all this interesting stuff in the archives around. They do this market research and they're very interested in it, but in the end, they're not quite sure it would work as a series for children. But there's certainly a real desire at the time for better quality children's stories in Australia on screen through books. And so she becomes part of that wave, actually, because then what happens with The Land Behind the World is after its 3,000 print run, which is basically self-published through Pinchgut Press, it gets picked up for republication through Ashton Scholastic. And they are a huge distributor of books through their book club, which goes into schools. And even now, it's still something that my children receive now every month or so, is that book club where you order some books and get it sent to your school. And that's how, in the end, I did the maths and essentially, including that first print run, there are more than 30,000 copies of this book that are printed and sold, including in New Zealand as well. And I think there's a print run there as well, a separate print run. And I don't know how many printed there. But it's amazing and says something about Australian culture amnesia that 30,000 copies of a book could be sold. And now it's almost like there's no trace of it. Like we've forgotten already in a short space of time in living memory that this book, which, you know, certainly had some impact, because I have in the time that I've started doing this project, I have met readers who remember this book as well, like I did, and happy to talk to me about it. And I'm keen for anyone else to reach out to me as well, who may remember this book or even knew Anne or Marge while they were alive.
Yes, I think there are many authors who would very much be jealous of 30,000 copies of their book being in circulation. And it wasn't the only book either. Anne published a number of other books as well, Sheila?
Yeah, so there's a follow-up that was also, the second book in this kind of quartet was also republished by Ashton Scholastic. So there was distribution of that one as well. And then there was a few other books that were self-published, but there was also another interesting volume I probably should mention too, because during this whole time, I mean, Anne, I think, is never really like flushed with cash or anything like that, but she works as a psychotherapist with Marge. So the two of them run women's groups and do psychotherapy work. And as a product of that professional relationship they have on top of their personal one, they produce a slim volume as well, which is a kind of a nonfiction book called Under the Surface, which is partly poetry from Marjorie Pizer and then prose pieces by Anne. And then that book, basically, they self-published that. They distribute 1,000 copies of that as well. And then that gets picked up. But actually, I think just after Anne dies, it gets republished by Angus and Robertson in hardback and does quite well as well. So it's interesting because these days, I mean, there are so many more authors working, so many more books out there. And to get these kinds of numbers, like you said, like would be incredible. But if you think about back then, the population of Australia is much smaller. So 30,000 copies is no mean feat, plus the follow-ups and that. But somehow she never I guess, quite gets there. And I mean, in my reading of this book now, and I read it for a fourth time recently too, just the other week, and I think it could have done with a bit more editorial development and a bit more support as well. But Anne's working in a time where writers aren't supported the way that they have now with writing courses and other ways you could improve your skills. Like, you can't just go Google and how to write a book or something like that. But I think Anne is really someone who succeeds against the odds. You know, she had the odds stacked against her. She was a young mother. Then she kind of leaves the marriage, becomes a mature age student at uni as well, which I think she finds a very challenging experience. But that does give her some of the confidence she needs to really sort of launch herself as a writer. And she has the chutzpah, I think, to really just self-polish and get her ideas out there, even if it's not necessarily a receptive environment in some ways as well. Because even back then, though, things like fantasy and science fiction in Australia, people don't quite know what to do with that genre of writing. But these days, of course, it's probably one of the biggest sellers in the bookstore is fantasy books.
Well, clearly there was something about what Anne Spencer Parry was doing in the land behind the world that resonated with many people. And the story of Anne's life behind that novel is an absolutely fascinating one. Sheila, thank you so much for speaking about it with us on Sunday Extra today.
Thanks, Julian. It was a pleasure.
That's Sheila Nock-Pham, who's the inaugural State Library of New South Wales Imago Fellow. And you can read an essay by Sheila that's based on her fellowship on the State Library website under the title The Land Behind the World. And if you want to find out more about Sheila, you can go to her excellently named website after the Smiths, SheilaTakeABow.com.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.